Fortune says, points to the rim. Wisdom points to the hub. I take you in sickness or health, poverty or wealth. I'm not marrying you for your money. I'm marrying you for your heart, you know? And a job. I once taught in a boys' prep school, and I watched these kids make this decision. Are you going to follow your star, or are you going to do what Dad suggests, where the money is? Well, if you shape your life for where the money is, it'll depend on whether you get the money or not, whether you'll have the life you want. But if you live for the heart, for the center, nothing can touch you. Then you go through. And that's the jump. That's the move up for youth. Then we come to maturity and the realization that power is not physical but spiritual. Here's a woman tearing open the jaws of a lion. So, and you might say also that that is the difference between macho and the gentle heart. It's a spiritual gentleness, compassion, and all of that which has more power than just physical strength. Then we come to one that has given a great many people who've been trying to interpret these things some problems. The hanged man, what does that mean? Well, in the south of France and in Italy, that is the sign of social disgrace, when a person is hung upside down. I remember when Mussolini was assassinated, that picture in the paper, Mussolini, his mistress, and his principal general hung upside down. Social disgrace. We're going to execute justice, aren't we? You can't worry about whether you're going to get the votes in the next election. You must be utterly indifferent to the social approval or disapproval. You're acting in terms of justice. So you can begin to see what's the matter with some of our things that go on. The hanged man. And then, passing to the spiritual, you are dead to the world. This is the corpse. That's the four of them. Those are the three tests of youth, maturity, age, and old age. Indifference to death. I might say something about old age, though, briefly. With youth, as I said, everything is in prospect. And everything you're doing is going to lead to a result. There comes a time when there's no future. And so you're not living for results at all, but for the moment that you're in. And the whole world becomes luminous. It takes on a this is it. Here and now quality that is simply wonderful. And it's a slow realization that may come over you, but that's what happens. And suddenly life is plastic. It's three-dimensional and radiant, and not simply something in the service of radiance that's going to be later on. It's a big change. And that's the death thing that does that for you. So here we have now, these are the lower systems. These are the roles in life. These are the virtues that move and inform those roles. This is the decision line. And so we come now to the stages in the spiritual experience. First, the temperance, from the physical to the spiritual. If we have made that jump, then we review, as Dante did, the facts and experiences of his life from the standpoint of transformation. And you will come to the knowledge of your spiritual being as well through your vices and guilts as through your virtues and grandeur. Both teach you of these mysteries. The yin-yang, you know, both. Just the totalities like this. So Dante, after meeting Virgil, goes down it through the hell. That's to say, he reviews the life that he has lived and doesn't stay stuck in any of the circles. In hell, people are stuck. This is the Tower of Destruction, the thunderbolt. Giambattista Vico said that man's first notion of the voice of God came with the voice of the thunder. That terrifying crack. Joyce uses it in Finnegan's Wake all the time, you know. On the very first page, when Finnegan falls from the ladder, the sound of his falling down the ladder, because he's been drinking and his head goes a little dizzy, the sound of God's voice comes down. The fall, ba 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 dal harag to kamina run con brun ton a run tuan thun, to bar horn on scorn to hoo 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 of a once more straight old pa. That's the thunderbolt. That's the thunderbolt of Joyce. And then the star, the first light of the heavenly dimension. Now, the revelation, the light revelation, is of about four different orders, as one learns from Tibet. First is the revealing light, the light that just lets you know there is such a dimension of the world. Then comes the increasing light. And then the perfected light. And then the operating light. And you'll see how it works. So there we are. It works perfectly, right down the line. Here's the king judging by justice, indifferent to social opinion, and the judgment of God is in harmony with his judgment. The increasing light, the moon. When the moon is full, they tell me, the crabs come out and dance on the beach. Dogs and coyotes bark. All life is moved by this radiant generating, and it is the sphere of youth. Then it comes to maturity. Now, the key to this, I think, is in Nietzsche. In the introduction to the Thus Spake Zarathustra, Nietzsche says there are three stages of the spiritual life. The first is of childhood, the stage of the camel. The camel gets down on his knees and says, put a load on me. Learning, study, piling it on. And when the camel is well loaded, it struggles to its feet and trots out into the desert. And in the desert, the camel becomes a lion. And the job of the lion is to kill a dragon. And the name of the dragon is Thou Shalt. Every scale on this great big dragon has a Thou Shalt written on it. Some date from 4000 BC, others date from the morning newspaper. And when you have killed the Thou Shalt, the third and final transformation is of the child. One becomes as a child. Or as Nietzsche says, ein aussichtrondes Rad, a wheel rolling out of its own center. Just out of its own center. So we have the child here. That's perfect. There's the full sun of consciousness. All shadow has been wiped out. All dragons are killed. All thou shalt are gone. And like Parsifal, moved by compassion, but without the thou shalt to block him, the world is saved. Isn't it marvelous? It's right here, the same story that we've been dealing with. And then the judgment, heavenly judgment, the final functioning revelation that that brings you, resurrects you from the dead, from the wasteland, and brings you to life again. It's pretty good. The life beyond death. Next, the world. This is over the old man. But you notice Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John there? Now you know why the pulpits were preaching against this pack of cards. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it. You don't have to wait till doomsday for the coming of the Savior. There she is. This is the female androgyne, a very important figure in alchemical thinking. Now the colors, yellow, God the Father, red, God the Son, blue, God the Holy Spirit. The kingdom of the Father spread upon the earth, and then that's his, right here, right here, right here. That's the final thing. And then, at the end, you are the fool. Wandering through the world, careless of criticism, the dogs or critics will bite the seat of your pants. Don't even turn around to give them a look. It's good advice to any artist unless he's in the theater. In the theater, you won't be able to open the show the next morning, the next day. But I had a funny experience up in San Francisco. I was invited to lecture at the medical center there. That's very ponderous stuff. And I read, as they say, read my paper. Of course, I didn't have a paper. And then some other people read their papers. And then came 2 days later, I was on a panel with four people. And one was a young Sanskritist from Berkeley who was very pompous about himself and about his Sanskrit and all, and deliberately throwing cracks at me all the way through. And I sat there and thought, well, what do I do with this guy? And then the MC, he said, Dr. Kim, would you like to reply to Professor So-and-so? Now, think of this. I said, well, the Winnebago Indians have a medicine ceremony inducting young men into the ways of life. And one bit of advice that's given to them there is, as you go on the way of your life, the birds of the air will shit on you. Don't pause to wipe it off. And I didn't dare look at that young man beside me. But this is the same principle. There's the total thing. I ran into a woman the next day in a museum who'd been there, and she said, oh, Joe, that bird shit thing was marvelous. The laughing went on for about 50 minutes ago. It took people time to get it, you know. They got away. Now, this is a woman artist friend of mine, and her name is Lee Shillereff in Chicago. And that, I think, is a rather good feminine view of the heroic life. See, I just love it. It's great. All right. Well, that's my story for this afternoon. Someone just push that lever down and kill the machine so we can talk. That's it. Thank you. Now, I should think after all this, there might be some questions. Yeah?
When, at the point in the story, the Parsifal story,
yeah.
When he goes finally back to ask the question, the messenger of the Grail comes to, I think it's Gawain's wedding at that point.
Yes, that's right.
Now, before that, he is unable to go back to the Grail Castle because you only get one try.
Yes.
How is it that he got another try?
When Trevor sent the hermit whom he had visited, heard of this, and saw Parsifal, he said, Parsifal, by your courage and compassion, you have changed the laws of God. That's good European man-first stuff. God is a function, God experienced is a function of your manner of experience. The elementary idea of God is transcendent of all forms, of all names. The tongue has never soiled it. You've never got there. So any idea of God is historically conditioned. It's a local idea. No matter how much noise people may make about it, it's just a local notion. And so, as man transforms, so are the laws of God transformed. The laws of God are functions of the human psyche in its historic expression and development. That's what we get here. This is Wolfram. Yes?
When you spoke of the Parsifal and that line down the middle of the
Parsifal, yes, through the middle.
Well, the line down the middle of the current theological thinking of the age. I remembered reading an introduction to Euripides that said the god that he presented in his place had absolutely nothing to do with the normal Greek gods of the day. And I thought of, if I remember correctly, the god that King Lear calls upon in Shakespeare is, again, very little connected to the current notion at that time of what the Christian god was.
As you follow any tradition, any historical tradition of God knowledge, the early stages are really relatively naive. The gods are thought of as though they were out there. As though the gods were out there. And then there comes a stage where the people realize that those gods are created by the human imagination, and they speak of something that transcends them. Now, with our biblical tradition, where God is a kind of supernatural fact beyond which there is nothing, we're stuck with the concretization of a folk idea. That primitive traditions and most of the Oriental traditions do not see the image of God as a supernatural fact anywhere. A God is a personification of a quantum of energy, life energy. Now, there are two orders of gods, you might say. The image that is supposed to represent the totality of the energy pouring into the world. You know, that's the highest personification, but the energy is first. The personification is going to be conditioned by the historical conditions of the personifier. Do you see the point? It seems to be very clear. And then that totality of the energy pouring into the world manifests itself through different modes. These are usually symbolized as the elements, you know, fire, air, earth, and water, and so forth. And then you have a pantheon. Pantheons are personifications of the energy of life in its various modes of manifestation. It's as easy as that. So the main thing to realize is the concept of energy consciousness, which is the support, the ground of all being, and can't be named. It's undifferentiated. It has no factuality. All facts are manifestations of that energy. The syllable om is in the Kundalini spoken of as the sound that is not made by any two things striking together. The sound of one hand clapping. That sound is the sound of the energy of the universe of which all things are manifestations. So, first is sound. Then manifestations. The manifestations include images of God. God second. You just have to put that in your head if you're going to compare mythologies with each other. I had a funny experience with Buber years ago. He was in New York lecturing to a small group about this size. And I got the notion. I didn't know what he was talking about when he was talking about God. I didn't know what he meant. Did he mean the mystery behind the galaxies, the millions of galaxies, or did he mean that character in the Old Testament? Or what was he talking about? So I raised my hand, and he asked me, well, what is it, Mr. Campbell? I said, well, there's a word being used here today that I don't understand. And he said, what is it? I said, God. You don't know what God means? I said, I don't know what you mean by God. You've told us God has hidden his face. People are not experiencing God anymore. I've just come from India, but people are experiencing God all the time. Now, what do you think he said to that? Mm. Do you mean to compare? Mm. Oh.
Who was that you were speaking of?
Martin Buber. What he has done has been to convert his folk idea into his notion of the elementary idea. Of course you can compare. Not always to the advantage of the local idea either. But that's important. Yes?
I guess I can sustain my metaphoric appreciation of the romances as stories of the psyche and its quest for knowledge. But after a while, you put that aside, and what you see is aristocrats going off along their sword and wrecking civilizations in their wake.
And the Which civilization did they wreck?
Well, the...
No, I mean, we're being specific now.
Think of all...
This is the 12th century.
Well, what gets abandoned are the women. Arthur's whole court is destroyed by courtly round, by Guinevere and Lancelot.
In what of the romances?
Well, I don't know if the romances...
They're not the ones I've been talking about. I'll tell you what happened with Tennyson. Right? Tennyson got the point of view that you're rendering, you see. And the love of Lancelot and Guinevere destroyed the court. That you don't find in these things. I'm talking about the 12th century romances.
Okay, so the question is this. Would the Grail itself represent community, which is what...
No. It represents the spiritual realization of the individual potentialities.
So that the question, let me put it another way. Must the world wait for aristocrats to solve their psychic battles before?
I don't want to argue about that Marxist problem. These aristocrats are the ones that created European civilization. They did. And when their aristocratic sentiments began to evaporate, civilization began to go to pieces. Well, just read your history. That's all there is to it. These are the men who created European civilization.
But we're not holding up medieval civilization as a possible psychological ideal for now, are we?
I wasn't saying that. I was speaking about the values, the psychological, spiritual values that are represented here. If you don't want them, let them go. But a lot of people find that we've lost something. I had a very interesting experience last weekend, lecturing on this same subject in New York. The words that Gottfried uses when he's speaking about the experience of love, the one heart that is two, the two hearts that are one, and all that sort of thing. And there was a lady in the audience raised her hand and said, "Oh, but that's just a metaphor." And I said, "It's not a metaphor when you're having the experience." When you have the experience, that's the best way to talk about it. Now, these people are having a set of experiences that are not current in the contemporary world, and certainly not on TV or in the journalists' world. And these sentiments have gone, have left us. But it's my feeling that, for some of us at any rate, they are of personal value and use. The idea of the gentle heart, the idea of compassion. I wasn't talking about going around destroying civilization and leaving women behind. I was talking about finding one's rapport, one's relationship with the world in a way of compassion and gratitude. I didn't get any of these words that you brought in. You brought in another lecture.
Well, I didn't do that at all. What I was suggesting was that there's a way in which these myths, these legends and romances do speak to a certain aspect of the contemporary mind. That is, the quest for to find one's own way, to explore, to be the wheel that devolves your own hub. These are key things that no one would ever discard. They're fundamental archetypes of the psyche.
Well, good.
And yet, that kind of concentration can lead to narcissism, can lead to a turn away from social, cultural, community concerns. And, it seems to me that kind of luxury is something that we ought to examine.
Why is it a luxury?
Well, you could explain the state that we're in because of that sort of luxury.
We have very little of it. Very little of it. So, luxury. You know what you're bringing in here? The third temptation of the Buddha. Social dharma. The very thing that brought about the wasteland. And what I'm talking about is an individual finding the authenticity of his own life course, not simply doing what everybody in the newspapers tells him to do, making the decisions of his own life, moving in with compassion. Selflessness is a fundamental here, not greedy grabbing. I don't see that. But it's a standard. You're bringing in a standard point of view that I've been listening to for 50 years. Whenever anybody tries to make something out of himself, oh, gee, he's not taking part in the recent, whatever it is. strike or parade or whatnot. There's an inner life as well as an outer. Now, you've spoken about the danger of the inner life. It turns one into a narcissist. But there's the danger of the outer life, too, that leaves you just a blank. And we got plenty of those around. So I heat up a little bit on this one. Yes?
In the discussion around the authentic life, I was interested in the aspect of the woman or the female. She didn't seem in any of the myths you talked about to have any consideration for an authentic life. That didn't seem to be part of the American canon.
Well, the problem with these myths and epics is they come off the man's pen. men have written them. We have very little that women have written, even lately, comparatively, you see. And also, the role of the woman here in this is of inspiration and fulfillment. And the women in the courtly love thing, they were the ones that were controlling the game. There's no doubt about it.
But that's not authenticity.
Well, the woman is looking for authenticity in a relationship, so she delays, merci, until she is guaranteed that this man who's proposing himself to her is one of a gentle heart. What the woman is not in, I mean, in the old society, not today. The woman is not in the active role. She is vulnerable more than the male. And she here, with her vulnerability, has found a way to guarantee to herself that what she gets in a male is love, not lust. And so she determines the relationship. Now, I've read a lot of these things. I mean, I spent 2 years in Paris on exactly this material. And the women were in control. That's all there's to it. The man is the one who's advancing, and he's the one who's performing the acts of guarding bridges or whatever bit of foolishness she puts on him. But the she's in control. And her problem is to live in a relationship that is authentic of love. And the only way she can do it is by testing the one who offers himself. She isn't offering herself. He's offering himself. Do you see what I mean? And she's in control of what happens then is step two. At least that just looks to me. I may be wrong.
Well, I have some problem with the issue of control, and that's what I was...
I see. The woman, the judgment of the woman was as follows. If she grants mercy too soon, she's a savage. I mean, she's someone who's just lusting herself. If she refuses merci after accepting the service, she's savage. And there are plenty of examples that come up in the stories of women of that kind. And it's a matter of interaction, interplay between the male and female, so that that highest, most sweet and noble experience of mutual love and fulfillment through the other can be realized. That's what it's all about. And these people had that idea. And it was very different from the idea of social marriage. Now, with respect to marriage in general, there are two main stages to it. The first half of life, you might say, is the biological marriage. You bring forth children and all that. And a lot of people go apart when the children have left. I mean, it's just as most discouraging. You hear one after another, people that you know, they 30 years together and boom, they're off. They're omitting this, what I call the alchemical marriage, that which is the experience of the second half of life in marriage, not bringing up children, all that, that's all done. But how about the two that are one and the one that are two, and having that come as an experience? And that's what the second half's all about. And if you don't have the notion of that, then you wonder why we're together again, or still. You have the notion of marriage as pleasure. Marriage as a long love affair. It isn't. Marriage is an ordeal. And the ordeal is exactly that of dissolving the individual integrity into a larger, into a participation. That's what it's all about. And it's rendered on two levels. One, the participation in bringing up a family. The other, the participation in realizing the two that are one and the one that are two. I don't see any...
Then one more question about that. How does individuation fit into that?
That is individuation. You're acting in terms of what you as ego have decided. You have evaluated. You're not just accepting what people have put on you. And you're not just playing a role. Do you see what I mean? It's you makes the decision, your values.
We're choosing then to be in a relationship in which the two become one, and by that choice, that is an individual choice?
It sure is. It's an individual test in the first place that's put on the other person, then you make up your mind, and then you act. I don't see anything complicated about that. Yeah.
But it's just also nice in terms of what you brought up, that at the same time Lady Murasaki was writing The Tale of Genji, which is the woman's self-conscious articulation of just really what you said, but it is from the pen of the woman.
Oh, good. That's great. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Here is the same kind of aristocratic spiritual game, and Lady Murasaki gives it in the Genji.
And she makes the point that, in fact, it is the women. I mean, even the fact of her writing, the men at the time had turned to China and were all looking outside for their culture, but she was taking the Japanese language and making the true art from it, and in so doing also was showing how women were binding the world together through the cultivation of arts and refinement.
Exactly. It's the same period, too.
Yeah.
And it's an aristocratic affair. I mean, from the literature that's most current nowadays, we fail to realize that civilization is the fruit of aristocratic action and sentiments. It's not the folk. The folk gets what falls down to them. Yes?
To get ready for your presentation, we read a book at the University Library yesterday about the myth, and in this particular translation, we don't know if it's standard or not, because we haven't read that many. When the knight gets up and says, I propose a quest and to find the grail, and next time you see it unveiled, Arthur says to this knight, Sir Gawain, you have mortally wounded me. It will take more than a year and a day, and you have destroyed the round table.
Oh, I tell you what this is. That's the second part of the chapter I'm quoting. The chapter is in the old French romance of the quest of the Saint Graal. Mallory, in the Morte d'Arthur, which is a 15th century work, and is based on his translation into 15th century English of the French texts, Mallory omits the sentence that I gave you. But then Arthur said, you have mortally wounded me, because what about the Grail? And what the implication is, more important than the social organization is the individual realization, and that's what the Grail is. It's the individual realization. Do you see that? Do you see what I'm saying?
Not. Could you say it one more time?
They thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Arthur liked people in groups. He could then be king, boss. They entered the forest, each where he had chosen, where there was no way or path. That is omitted in Mallory. And so the, what might be called the spiritual positive, is not given by Mallory. All he gives is, oh gee, whom am I going to boss around, says Arthur. This is exactly where the individual quest comes out as the highest adventure of the spirit. Now, they had worked it out, the group thing. They had done all that. It's done. The second half of life, what about it, you know? Have your individual realization. But what good is a society of empty barrels? People who haven't found their inner life and don't know how to find it. They only know how to hold hands and dance around in circles. What about what's inside? It's not impossible then to hold hands and dance in circles. Yeah.
Yes. Well, the image of the individual breaking into a larger unity through encountering the other person, can that also be represented as a step that's taken in within society? I mean, when the knights go onto their individual paths, they must encounter other castles, other people, interact with them in some way. And is there a step in which perhaps the person returns with this understanding without being absorbed into the circle, works within the circle by individual choice to be part of it rather than...
Remember the Yvain story that I just summarized very briefly of Yvain pouring the water on the rock and then killing the king and becoming the consort of the woman of the castle. Then the court comes, you see, and here, you're being an individual, you know, what about this? Come join us. So he does join them and goes back and forgets his individual life. He forgets his individual spirit. And then comes the long ordeal of bringing the two together. Now, you can't join the individual spirit to the group spirit if you haven't found your individual spirit yet. And the group will tell you all about the group spirit. So the individual quest is an individual quest, and you got to find it. Otherwise, you become what Joyce calls an ordinary dime a dozen type. You don't have an individuality. You just haven't found yourself. You are a stuffed shirt.
In a way, you have to have the
quoting cliches and
yeah. Is it true that when you find something of a spiritual nature in yourself as an individual, you also at the same time are aware of the interrelatedness of all things?
Well, isn't that it? That's the story. And then you find what those people are that are all around you. Now, there's a lovely little story I like to tell, a Hindu fable of the tiger among goats. There was a tigress who was starving, hungry, and pregnant, very close to the giving birth. She came upon a little flock of goats, and in pouncing on them, brought about the birth of the little one and her own death. She overdid it. The goats scatter, and they come back to their little grazing place, and what they find is a just-born little tiger and its dead mother. Well, they have very strong parental instincts, and they adopt the tiger, who grows up thinking he's a goat. He learns to bleat. He learns to eat grass. His teeth can't chew the grass very well, the wrong kind of teeth. And his stomach can't digest the cellulose. So he grows to be a pretty miserable specimen of his kind. When this poor little wretch reaches adolescence, a big male tiger comes, pounces on the little flock, and they scatter. But this little fellow isn't a goat. He didn't run away. He's standing there. And the big fellow looks at him and says, "What? You living here with these goats?" Says the tiger. The big one is mortified. Like a father coming home and finding his son with long hair. So he swats him back and forth a couple of times and picks him up by the neck and takes him to a pond where the water is perfectly still. Now the second aphorism of the Yoga Sutra says, yoga is the intentional stopping of the spontaneous activity of the mind. Our mind is always in action. Try to hold it still. Try to hold in your mind one thought or one image for 10 seconds. You'll find you've got associated images all over the place. So it is. Our minds are like a pond blown by a wind. And all the images in our minds are come and go, are broken reflections. We identify ourselves with one of those reflections. We say, oh, here I come, there I go, oh dear. But make the pond stand still. And then you see the form of forms, the image of images that's broken up in all these images. And that's you. And that's also you. And you. And you. So the little tiger looks over into the pond and he sees for the first time his own face. And the big tiger puts his face over the pond too. And he says, "You see? You've got the face of a tiger. You're not a goat. You're like me. Be like me." That's this guru stuff. The pictures. Well, the little one's sort of getting an idea. And the big fella takes him then to his den, where there are the remains of a recently slaughtered gazelle. Big fella takes a chunk of this bloody stuff and he says, "Open your face." "Well," says the little one, "I'm a vegetarian." "Oh," says the big fellow, "none of this nonsense." And he shoves it down his throat. And the little tiger chokes on it. And the text says, as all do on true doctrine. So, choking on the true doctrine, it's nevertheless getting into his system, into his nerves, into his bloodstream. It is activating his proper nature. His proper food activates his proper nature. And he sees a tiger, so For the first time in his life, he gives a little tiger stretch. A little tiger roar comes out. Tiger roar 101. And the big one says, there we are. Now we go into the forest and eat tiger food. Now there's a moral here, that we're all tigers living with these goats. And as a goat. And the function, of course, of our sociology department is to teach us how to be goats. Live with the group. And the function of spiritual information, mythology, meditation, and so forth, is to introduce us to our tiger face. But when you have found your tiger face, how are you going to live with these goats? You better not let them know. You better not let them know that you found your tiger face. When Jesus said, I and my Father are one, they crucified him. When Halaj said, I and my beloved are one, they crucified him. I think it was Halaj who said, the function of the Orthodox community is to give the mystic his aim, namely union with the with the all. After the death of Halaj, the Sufis got the message. And this is the answer. You wear the outer garment of the law. You do. And the inner garment of the mystic way. But let me just say, before you put on the outer garment, you've got to put on the inner one, huh? I mean, that's just the order of getting dressed. So there's that. And when it comes time to live with all the goats, it's no problem, because you know that they're tigers. It's just there. They haven't caught on yet. So that's my message for this afternoon. Thank you. That tiger among goats story, by the way, is one inflection of a standard story. It's that of the son of the king who, when he's born, is exposed, put out in the woods and picked up by animals or peasants or something like that. So he grows up thinking he's a hunter, let's say. Then the king dies. And the dynasty people in charge of all that say, well, gee, the king's son is out there. We've got to send for him. So they go out and they say to him, come in, you are the king's son. What, I'm the king's son? I thought I was a hunter. And the Sanskrit for king's son is Rajaputra. Raja is king, putra is son. And then with the syllable vat on the end, which means like, Rajaputravat, like the king's son. So it is with the tiger. So it is with each of us. You've been the tiger all the while, and you thought you were a goat. And Rajaputravat, you find you are the tiger. It's not a development. It's just a change of perspective, seeing that the kingdom of the Father is spread over the earth, and it's you. It's not a bad story. One way or another, this that I've been trying to sing here this afternoon and this morning is the song that I've been hearing through myths all over the world. And this medieval one, I think, is particularly appropriate to our world insofar as we are of European rather than, let's say, Near Eastern or Farther Eastern mind, the idea of the individual journey, that no one can live your life. And if you don't live it, you have not lived your life, and that's the wasteland. That's the sense of it. Doing what everybody told you. The third temptation of the Buddha, perform your duty to society. Your duty is no good to society unless you can bring society something that is you and that is authentic and isn't simply repeating. So, now, I'm...